If you want to open your Bible to a passage, I would say open to 1 Peter chapter 3, even though we're not really going to be getting into 1 Peter chapter 3 this morning. That's going to be next week. This morning's lesson is not expository. It's topical, but it's meant to be a setup for our expository study of 1 Peter 3 next week. Because we're in a part of Peter that's been talking about relationships. Relationships in the church, relationships in society, in civil society in regard to government, relationships in business. And with chapter 3, verse 1, we're going to be talking about relationships in a marriage, relationships in a family. And so I want to take this morning to speak on some things I've not spoken on for a long time. And that's because the material this morning is usually intended for younger folks who maybe are dating, considering marriage, or young couples in marriage. And since we haven't had many of you like that for some time, I've kind of stayed away from this subject, but we've got some young people here and some fairly newlywed people here, so it's time for a lesson like this, I think. And so this morning I'm going to talk about rules for relationships. And these are things that I believe are biblically grounded. I'll try to show that. But they're things I've collected over 50 years of preaching. They didn't all come from me by any means whatsoever. But I believe they are things that any individual who is considering entering into a relationship with a member of the opposite sex needs to know about and remember and keep in mind. The importance of relationships is that when we enter one, we are holding the soul of another human being. Because in every relationship, there's a sense in which two or more become one. Now, we often understand two becoming one in reference to marriage. That's the first use made of it in Scripture. But on a football team, 11 become one. A football team's a relationship in which 11 men are meant to function as one. In a business office, the boss and the secretary are a situation where two become one, not in a marital sense, but in a business sense. They function together as a single unit. I had lunch this past week with a lifelong friend, and he told me for the first time, he'd never told me this story before, that his great aunt, I forget her name, was the secretary to Harry Truman when he was in the Senate and when he was vice president. Now, when Roosevelt died and he became president, they had a presidential secretarial pool that they had to pull from to be a secretary of the president. So at that point, she became Bess Truman's secretary. And my friend was telling me he was over in Independence, Missouri one time at the Truman Library. I've been there a couple of times. It's a great museum. And he asked someone if they'd ever heard of his aunt. He gave the name, and they were shocked. In fact, that very afternoon, they were having a parade from the library up to the Truman House, which is less than a mile away. They asked if he would ride in the lead car, just because he was related to this lady who had meant so much to Harry Truman in a professional relationship. And so when we enter a relationship, we're taking on responsibility for another soul. And for that reason, it's important we understand some things about relationships. Now, I'm going to have six pieces of advice to women and then to men in considering a relationship. But let me preface those with some general observations that apply equally to whether you're a man or a woman. The first of which is that in every relationship, your relationship with God must come first. That's where it all begins. Without a personal, meaningful, growing relationship with God, whatever relationship you're entering is going to be in trouble, and probably on rocky ground. It's because of our connection to Christ that our connection to everybody else that we're in a relationship with falls into place. Relationships should begin as friendships. They should not begin in hormones. They should not begin in chemistry. Now, those things come into play, but the physical attraction that often brings two people together turns out to be a very bad glue. It doesn't hold people together very long. And when that starts to fade away, you need something much deeper than mere physical beauty. And what you need is friendship. You need that connection that enables you to relate to a person on areas other than simply the physical. Now, you may be friends with a member of the opposite sex and it never becomes anything more than that, and that's fine. You may not even have a friendship with a member of the opposite gender, and that's fine too. There is no sin in not being married. But marriage is a blessed state in which two people come together. It's a God-ordained relationship. A marriage is going to involve the most important decisions you ever make in life. And for that reason, we have to be careful about it. Relationships are not neutral. When you were in school, there were kids, if you hung with them, they would probably get you in trouble. And there were kids, if you hung with them, things would probably turn out pretty good. And so it is with thinking about someone you're going to marry. There are people you could marry, and they're going to take you straight into agony. And there are other people you could marry, they're going to help you get to paradise. And it's amazing to me how when it comes to a person picking a mate, parents and adults tend to back off. I mean, in growing up, a child depends on the parents for what they're going to wear, what they're going to study in school, what sport they're going to play, if they're going to be in the band, what shoes they're going to pick out, what kids in the neighborhood they're going to hang around with. They depend on the parents for homework. And then comes the most important decision they're going to make. And that is in regard to whom they're going to marry. And suddenly, parents, adults, don't give any advice. My friend Steve Thiel, who grew up the first 18 years of his life in India, a couple months back showed me a page he had saved from 1960, somewhere in there, from an Indian newspaper. And it's what we would call the classifieds, except that most of the classifieds were placed by parents seeking a spouse for their child. I mean, you know, a big sheet of newspaper like they used to make them, and you know how classified ads are, and they would describe their child, my child's educated, my child plays an instrument, and we're looking for this kind of person, and just one after another. Now, I'm not coming out advocating arranged marriages, but you could do worse than having an arranged marriage for this reason. Parents are usually pretty good at picking out the jerks, at picking out the persons who are irresponsible and immature, who are losers, who might be adept at getting their child into trouble. I can just imagine Sab's parents saying, "Sab, you can do better than that Nettles boy. I mean, what kind of a name is Nettles? And he's just so tall. And he's going to be a lawyer, a farmer. What does he know about being a farmer? Oh, his grandfather was. Well, you know what? My grandfather was a brain surgeon. That doesn't qualify me to be a brain surgeon." And so Sab said, "Yeah, but he sent me roses." You know, so that changes everything. But We need to listen to older people who understand life better than we do and who can help us see things that maybe we're not seeing. Now, what often happens when two people meet and they decide they're going to make a go of it, they see the problems, but they think we can work through these after we get married. Yeah, I know my boyfriend's got a big problem here, but we'll get that fixed after we get married. And rarely does it happen that way. When you're dating, you are on your best behavior. You're trying to hide who you really are from the other. You're trying to convince them that you're somebody that you really aren't. And people who are dating need to be careful. They need to be exposed to the other in enough situations to see what kind of person they're really hanging around with. How do they react when they get stuck in a traffic jam and are late getting somewhere? How do they react when the cashier gives them too much change when they pay the bill, assuming they pay the bill? What are they going to do when it comes time for the holiday? Who are they wanting to be with? Which family are they going to spend time with? I may have told this story before, but I have a good friend who did a lot of marital counseling, and he was counseling a couple one time and told them, now today we're going to talk about conflict resolution. And the gal pipes up and says, oh, we don't have to talk about conflict resolution. We don't have any problems. We get along just fine. We can go on to the next lesson. My friend said, oh, is that so? Well, where are you going to spend Christmas this year? And the guy pipes up, with my family. And the lady looks at him, oh, no, we're going to spend it with my family. And they get in a big argument about where they're going to spend Christmas right there in front of him. And he said, can we now get serious in talking about conflict resolution? And so, before entering a relationship, you know, couples get in a hurry-up offense. We've got to get married. And they just blow through all of the red lights. And if you don't have a friendship with a person, if you don't enjoy talking with them, if you cannot be comfortable in introducing them to your family, if they're trying to isolate you from your parents or your friends or your church, you probably need to pass on them. I'll tell you what, it is better to cry because you lost them than to cry because you got them. And so we need to have our eyes open to the problems that can come. Now, with all of that said, let me suggest six things that a girl should look for in a boy that she may be considering getting into a relationship with. Number one, does he have a relationship with the Lord? Is he committed to developing his relationship with Christ? Does he consider himself a disciple? Is he a believer who is wanting to grow closer to Christ? Will he be the spiritual leader in your home? I've seen so many marriages where the husband simply fails to be the spiritual leader. If there's any leading that's done at all, it's usually then by the wife. Will he be a co-nurturer with you of your children? Number two, is he a man of integrity? Does he cheat at cards when you sit down to play euchre? Does he cheat at Monopoly? You know, if a guy's going to cheat at something like that, a board game, he'll probably cheat at anything, including cheating on his wife in his marriage. In his job, is he honest with people? Does he falsify travel expenses to get more money? Does he lie to people about the product he's trying to sell or trying to represent? Women need to be looking for men who are honest to a fault. And if he doesn't have that kind of integrity, you need to stay away from him. Number three, is he able to lead boldly? Now, I'm not talking about being a quarterback. I mean, a quarterback is a leader. But I mean, is he able to think for himself? Is he able to analyze data and draw proper conclusions based on that? Everybody's going to make mistakes. And one of the characteristics of a true leader, a bold leader, is to admit the mistake when he makes it and to back up and correct it and then move on from there. A person who is incapable of admitting mistakes is someone you don't want to be connected with in any kind of relationship. Is he selfish as a leader? And let me tell you this, and I'm not going to have time this morning to develop this, but in every headship position, in every leadership position, there is an element of submission. And in every position of submission, there is an element of leadership. It's not that the man is the leader totally, solely, and it's the wife who has to submit totally, solely. A leader is a submitting leader, and a submitter is a leading submitter. Look at Ephesians 5:21 sometime in connection with that. Maybe next week when we get into 1 Peter 3, 1 and 2, we'll be able to talk about that more. But if you've got a guy who has to have it his way all the time, my way or the highway, who does not understand the servanthood and the submission he is to bring to the relationship, that's not a guy you want, and neither do you want a guy who is so insecure in his decisions that he's got to call mom up to get her advice on which t-shirt he should buy. You want a guy a little more confident in his own decisions than that. Number four, does he love sacrificially? And this quality is expressed in some subtle ways. When you have a party, have some folks over, does he help clean up after everybody has left? Does he have an aunt who takes you aside and says, you know, my nephew would come over and visit with me, and he would do things with me, and he'd sit and talk with me. Was he considerate enough? Is he considerate enough to do things like that? How does he deal with visitors, strangers who come in, who walk in? How does he treat waitresses at the restaurant? With rudeness or with kindness? In things like that, you'll find out if he has a sacrificial heart or not. Number five, he should be able to laugh heartily. Laughter is the best medicine. I don't mean you look for the class clown, but you look for someone who not only can laugh, but can laugh at himself, who doesn't take himself so seriously. I've got this book, Ragman, by an author I've enjoyed reading over the years, Walter Wangerin. And he tells this story. I want to read you part of this story. He's talking about when he and his wife were newly married and problems would come up, how they would deal with it. His wife would start crying. That's how she would deal with the problem. She'd start crying. And he would deal with it by stomping out of the house and staying gone out walking the streets for 2 or 3 hours. So both of them were involved in passive-aggressive behavior. She'd cry, he'd pout, and leave the house. And so he's talking about a time, they lived in St. Louis, when they had really had an epic battle, that's what he calls it, disagreement over something. He doesn't tell us what it was. And there were the usual tears and the usual pleadings and the usual undeserved accusations that were made by each other. And finally, he's had all he's going to take. And so he says, all went well. She's crying, he's pouting. All went well right up to the jamming of my arms into the overcoat, the running downstairs, and the dramatic leap into the night. He's going to go out walk the streets for a couple of hours. He's going to show her. But then God piddled on the affair. When I slammed the front door, I caught my coat in it. Mad and madder, I rifled my pockets for the key to unlock the door to complete this most crucial tactic against his wife. But there was no key. My coattail was truly caught in the door, and the door was made of oak. I had two alternatives. Either I could shed the coat and pace around unprotected, but the problem was the temperature was below freezing. Or I could ring the doorbell. 10 minutes of blue shivering convinced me which was the more expedient measure. I rang the doorbell. So then my wife came down the steps, and she peeped out, and she unlocked the door. And what was she doing? Laughing. Oh, she laughed so hard the tears streamed down her face, and she had to put her hand on my shoulder to hold herself up. And I could have smiled a little bit too. I could have chuckled a tiny chuckle, for this was the gift of God arranging armistice, staging reconciliation between a wife and her husband, a gift more sweet than all the rains of heaven. Laughter, extraordinary forgiveness. But what did the dummy do, speaking about himself? Well, he batted her hand away, cried, "Humph!" and bolted to stalk the night more grimly than ever before. He should have wondered about the survival of his marriage, not by fight's distress, but by his stupid, blind, inordinate, and all-consuming pride. We can become prisoners of our refusal to laugh. You need to be able to laugh in a relationship. And number six, the husband should model humility. He should not be stuck on himself. He should be focused on others. If he cannot play the understudy, if he cannot play second string, if he can't be the second fiddle, if he always has to be the star in the limelight, ladies, keep looking. Now, six things guys look for in a girl, and these are very similar. You don't start guys by looking to see if she's drop-dead gorgeous. That's where most guys start. But here's some other suggestions. Just as with women, what about her personal faith and trust in the Lord Jesus? That's the basis for all the other qualities of the relationship. If you're unequally yoked in sin, in marriage, if you're unequally yoked in marriage, you're married to an unbeliever. You two worship different gods. You worship Christ, your spouse worships themselves. And that's going to cause problems. I can understand why Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7 to widows, if you remarry, marry only in the Lord. There's good reasons for that. You want to have a spouse who worships the same God as you. Number two, look for beauty that's more than skin deep. We'll get into this next week in 1 Peter chapter 3. Now, nobody starts out to marry an ugly woman. There was a great song back in the 60s. If you want to be happy for the rest of your life, never make a pretty woman your wife. You know, just find you an ugly woman and marry her. But that's not usually the way it works. But the beauty you're looking for is the beauty she cannot get at a beauty parlor. You're looking for the beauty that comes from the Bible, not from a beauty parlor. That's the beauty you want, that's on the inside and not just on the outside. Number three, you want a man who appreciates what you bring to the table, who appreciates your gifts. You want a man who will look to you for, or husbands, you want a wife you will look to for her ideas, for her contributions, ambitions, hopes, plans, gifts, dreams. Marry a woman smarter than you. For most men, that's not too hard to do. And having married a woman smarter than you, appreciate the fact she's smarter than you, and bless your life by availing yourself of her gifts. And a wife doesn't have to sit around waiting for her husband to give her a direction. And that gets back to this being a submissive leader. Wives lead men as much as men lead women. They do it in different ways. But women, if you ever find yourself in a relationship with a man who is not a spiritual leader, you need to step up and take the lead. You need to be at worship. You need to be at Bible study. You need to be with your brethren, worshiping Christ, whether your husband goes or not. In over 50 years of preaching, I can tell you that in every congregation I've been, there have been more women there without their husband than there have been husbands there without their women. Those brave women were willing to step up and be a leader in that, not by beating their husband over the head with a biblical 2x4, but just by their example of refusing to be absent when they needed to be at worship. Number four. Look for a woman who will boost your confidence. Now, you shouldn't need a whole lot of pats on the back to be the kind of man you are called to be. But Ephesians chapter 5 says that a wife is to respect her husband. And that involves this thing of a wife admiring her husband and helping his self-esteem by the confidence she puts in him. Not questioning, second-guessing every decision he makes, but by being supportive and submissive to the decisions that he makes. Number five. Look for a woman who displays kindness. Women are really good at displaying kindness, at being gentle. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 7, talks about how in a family, you've got the wife, you've got the father, the husband, the mother, the father. The mother brings tenderness to the table, the father brings toughness. And sometimes women lose a husband to death or other reasons. And for a woman to balance her natural tenderness with the need to be tough with her children is a hard balancing act. The wife of a woman and a man are not interchangeable. Now, sometimes you lose one or the other. Fathers make bad mothers, although they sometimes have to be a mother. And mothers make bad fathers, although they sometimes have to be a father. But men look for a wife who has that sweet gentleness and tenderness that she brings to your family. And then finally, look for a woman who has a sense of humor. That's going to help you get over a lot of rough spots. And so in all those things, I think you can find guidelines for having a strong relationship in marriage. And next week, Lord willing, we'll get into the biblical text to see what Peter says about the husband and wife relationship. Many years ago, I heard a story about a Christian woman whose husband was an unbeliever. He was a drunk. He came in drunk one Sunday morning, having been out all night. About the time the wife was getting up, getting ready to go to church. And in his drunken stupor, the man said, "Where are you going?" She said, "Well, I'm going to go to church." And he walked over and knocked her down with his fist. And then he said, "Now tell me where you're going." She said, "Well, I'm going to go to church." He walked over to the dresser, pulled a drawer open, took a gun out, walked over, put it against her forehead and said, "Now tell me where you're going." She said, "If you pull the trigger, I'm going to heaven. But if not, I'm going to church." And that's the kind of courage we sometimes have to bring to relationship.